Hello and welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this episode, we speak to adopter Peggy and birth parent Laura in relation to their experience of creating an open and ongoing relationship to best support the needs of the two children they are parents to. Their full story can be heard on their podcast, Two Good Mums. So here, we open up some of the less talked about challenges in what is a really honest and open conversation. We hope you find it enlightening, and as always, if you've experience of adoption, fostering or special guardianship from any perspective and would like to share that on the podcast, please get in touch through the Facebook or Twitter pages or email us at anfpodcast@gmail.com.
So my name is Laura. I am the birth mother to CJ and RJ. They were adopted by forced adoption when I was in my late teenage years, sort of mid to late teenage years. That happened due to an injury at the time. That the only thing I can say is that I didn't cause that, and at the time I didn't know who did. But due to that, that's why it was decided that I could no longer care for them. And then
over to me. Yes, I, along with my husband, we adopted CJ, and then we met Laura when she was pregnant with RJ. And so we can tell him that we've always known him. And so I think they were both came to us at aged 15 months, with there's 22 months between them, I think. So, and that was back in they're now 13 and a half and 15 and a half. So teenagers.
Many moons ago.
So, I don't know. What do you think's worth the potted version? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I just wanted to ask Laura, how do you define forced adoption? Because it's a term that's used. And as an adoptive parent, I'm not sure I really understand the kind of definition behind that, if that makes sense.
As opposed to sort of non-consensual adoption, which is maybe the legal language.
Yeah, so I would say that forced adoption is, and actually now that you're saying that, I would probably define CJ's adoption as forced adoption, and maybe in the end, RJ's ended up being more of a non-consensual kind of adoption.
Right.
Because with CJ's, I was always against it up until, you know, the judge put his gavel on the whatever and basically said, you know, adoption's where it's going. But then with RJ's, it was a bit different. I was against it, but then I chose along the path of it to not fight it.
Yeah.
So that's, it was still non-consensual in the process of, that's how it started. But in the end, I just chose not to fight it. So I guess now that you say that, okay. I think that I would probably define them both differently.
Right.
I think, I don't know whether I've introduced the term to you because it's a term that's used in Australia routinely. It's what's it's officially known as is forced adoption. I think that they don't do what we think of as forced adoption anymore. What we think of as historical or relinquished, so-called, I'm doing air quotes, relinquished adoptions. They, in Australia, they're called forced adoptions. And there's money set aside so that everyone who works with them is has had trauma-informed training on working with forced adoption. I mean, it is just the terminology in use in Australia.
I mean, I feel like we've sideswiped you before you even started. You've not even got into your story. because you've published a blog 10 episodes long, which I think which is Two Good Mums. And we'll put the link to that in the show notes. Also, Laura, you've written a book, haven't you?
About your experience.
What's that book about?
So the book itself takes a much deeper dive into my individual journey.
Yeah.
It talks about where I started, how I came to be a young mum, how I came to be with a child in foster care firstly, and then adoption, how all that sort of took place. It very much gives a lot of the details that nobody would usually hear, and if I'm going to be quite blunt about it, not a lot of people would ask. Because I feel that that's one of the things that birth parents don't get is the chance to actually tell their story from their side of things. And I tell it quite frankly, I tell it honestly. Even the bad parts, you know, there was no sense in keeping those back just to protect myself. If I was going to write a book, I needed to tell everything. So I did. I'm hoping, and the feedback's been really positive so far, that for me personally, I would like to reach other birth parents with the podcast and the blog. Those are the people at the moment that we're struggling to find. And I can understand that as a birth parent, that, you know, you don't really want to share with the world that you've lost a child to forced adoption or adoption in any kind of way if it wasn't just a choice. So I know there's not people just randomly standing around waving their hands in the air going, oh, I've lost my child to adoption. So you have to really go find them. And I'm hoping that the book reaches them and that they can learn that their voice is just as important as the other people in the triad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I think that we... there's lots of programs like Long Lost Family that sort of romanticizes the whole, all of adoption and every part in the adoption. But actually the contemporary reality is that birth parents are very much, from what I've seen, and I think you probably would agree, Scott, I would never dare to presume to put words in your mouth. But that we pay lip service to, well, maybe we'll meet the birth parents, but actually these people, and I say this really respectfully, I say that, the common thinking is that these people don't deserve their children.
Yes, there's a massive stereotype surrounding birth parents, and that is part of my work in Two Good Mums, is to try and break that wall down between adoptive parents and birth parents. There are going to be some circumstances where your worst nightmares might come true. They might, you know, there are parents out there that are going to be the worst version of what you could possibly think. Well, the majority of them are just, they've had a bad life and they've had bad things happen, and it's all been a case of circumstance and lack of support and people who've just lost their way. And do those people really, even if they can't care for their children, do they deserve to be stereotyped under the worst thing that you can imagine of a parent? And the answer is no, most of them don't. But until adoptive parents start actually giving birth parents the time to actually tell them about themselves and get to know them away from what they might have heard, then they're not going to know that. They're just going to carry on with that stereotype, and they're probably out there making, it's like Chinese whispers. It's, you know, if they don't find out the truth, they're just going to perpetuate that sort of falsehood about birth parents.
Yeah.
I just read the latest review of Laura's book, because it's by a birth mother, if you don't mind. It says, "I'm a birth mother impacted by forced adoption. I came across this book after following Two Good Mums on Instagram at a time which coincided with me writing my annual letterbox contact with my birth son. Despite now having two subsequent children in my care with no social services involvement, I'm still affected by the trauma of forced adoption and yearn for the direct contact that Laura and Peggy have built between them. This book, which I did not put down for 8 hours straight, gave me comfort and hope on the day that I needed some." So that really touched both of us, didn't it, Laura?
Wow.
Yeah, especially that last line. Yeah. Because that's exactly why I wrote the book. And I always told myself, if just one birth parent out there is helped by that book, then I've done my job. So that the first time in hearing someone say this book helped me, I was like, oh, yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
The other thing I'd add about the book is that I thought I knew Laura because we've been emailing forever and we've done the podcast and everything. But on reading the book, there was stuff in there that made me go, oh, I did not know that. And, you know, and I wouldn't want anyone who heard the podcast to go, well, I know the story, because as Laura calls it, a deeper dive, and it really is.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to ask you about that, Peggy, actually, because did you, before you were before you met Laura, before you spoke to her, were you one of those parents who I'll described earlier? You know, I mean, I think 15, 16 years ago when I was looking at my children, wondering how their birth parents could have done what they've done. But I've learned a lot. I've educated myself. I've been educated. Was that a thing for you, or did that was it different for you?
It was different for me for a couple of reasons. One is I was more aware of open adoption because that's how it's done in Australia.
Yeah.
So I was more just being more aware. It wasn't such a big deal to me.
Yeah.
But also I think that reading the file, there were a lot of red flags to me. I had an awareness of how to read the file because I have a degree in psychology. And so reading the file, there were so many mental health words bandied about with no actual diagnosis. That I thought they were red flags. I thought this doesn't represent the person. I just was able to go, that's a file that served a purpose. And that purpose was to get CJ sort of released for adoption. If I just looked at that file and didn't meet Laura, I would have a very different opinion of her, I think. But I kind of had enough awareness about me without bigging myself up to be able to look at that file and go, yeah, that's not a real person. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I also had the experience of having being assessed by social services. And I say this on the podcast, the things that they got wrong about me were literally laughable. They said I had leprosy and I don't look all my limbs. I don't have leprosy. Yeah. So I was kind of aware the mistakes.
Okay, hang on. How did that even...
I got no idea.
That is a massive spelling mistake there, isn't
that's
it? Leprosy.
Yeah. That's a whole podcast in itself.
There was a bit of cut and paste as well, because we were routinely called up by another couple's name as well.
Yeah.
So. But if mistakes can be made in mine, at least I got to look at my assessment and correct.
Yeah.
That I knew didn't happen for Laura. So I was, you know, we were all very keen, my husband and I both very keen to meet Laura because we'd had the training and it was a good thing to do. And it just removes any horns.
Yeah.
You know, she's just a real regular person. If anything, I met her and thought, she's a teenager.
Yeah.
A child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A child with child. So
how did you get then from this position of, you met, the adoption went through, you everyone got on with their lives, or, probably to different degrees, I would imagine that's really flippant, but life moved on. How then did you get to the point of sort of initiating more than just the standardized letterbox?
It was actually a result of that meeting, because we gave Laura some photographs, and those photographs appeared on her social media page. She had said to us in the meeting, I can't wait to put them in an album. And because we're really old fogies, we were like, oh, lovely, a bit nerdy, but she's going to stick them in an album. And Scott's got his face in his hands. But it was the beginning of social media. We kind of were vaguely aware we don't do it, And so social services got wind of this, and it was just when everything was kicking off and they were in crisis mode because teenagers were finding their families and they were putting out fires all over the place. And so that gave us a real heads up to this tsunami that was coming at us, that, our social worker, who was fabulous despite her cut and pasting of the report, she said that if children get their teenage years and haven't got all the information they need about their birth families, they're going to go looking.
Yeah.
And so that was really impetus. So that was a key thing for us, was how are we going to get ahead of this social media? And then, the short version is I went to adoption conference and Beth Neal was presenting some research, which gave us confidence, because it was like, if the adopters are open to the contact and if the family are accepting of the, not the fact that the child has been removed and adopted, but accepting of the placement, then that's when it works best. And because we'd met Laura, we could say, actually, we fit that, in the right quadrant of her results, kind of thing. It still took a bit of doing, though, because we didn't know how to get an email address to her. So we insisted on another meeting when RJ was placed with us.
Right.
Completely freaked Laura out.
How did that feel for you, Laura, though, when you got to that point? And, despite freaking out about the second meme, but was that a relief? Was it something that you hoped might happen?
It was scary at first. Yeah. No, it was something that was probably never even in the realms of
what I thought was possible at the time. I'd never even heard of being able to email them. And even letters were scary at that time. Doing letterbox was kind of a whole thing in itself. And so when they gave me the email and two social workers off to the side looking like the world has just fallen beneath them, and because they don't know what to do because it's so out of the normal. And,
yeah.
And so I'm like, so what do I do? Do I say yes? What do I do? I'm not sure how to react. And then I took it, and then I sort of got home, and then doubt set in and paranoia set in, and I thought, what if they were doing it just to be nice? What if they don't actually want me to email them and they were just trying to show that they were just being really nice to me? And you know, if
it doesn't make any sense now, does it? When you try and explain it to your parents.
And
it was a trick as well at some, I think.
Yeah, and one of the other things I worried about was I was still in a place where, to me, social services were just this big being in control of everything, and I still thought they held all the power. And whilst I knew it was Peggy and Chris's decision to give me that email, I thought social services could take that away. And so I was very reluctant to start something if it was going to be taken away.
Right.
So there was also that in the back of my mind, and that scared me more than I didn't want to get them in trouble either. Because throughout this entire thing, I've always been very cautious of how Peggy and Chris feel about everything. And so I didn't want to get them in trouble if I did start emailing them and social services came and being like, what are you doing this? Can't do that.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of thinking about it. It took a nudge from Peggy and Chris in a letter to actually start using it.
Wow. See, now that's interesting as well, because I think the perception is that most birth parents would
jump at the chance.
Jump and grasp and run straight away, you know? And to hear that, I mean, I understand your anxiety and stuff, but I really understand why you would have felt this might have been a trick. Because that's, you know, that is the experience of most birth parents who have had, or the perception of most birth parents who've had experiences with children's services, isn't it? Yeah. Sorry, Peggy, you were going to say something.
I think I was just going to follow up with, again, that it was so long ago. It was before these smartphones, so you had to log on to check your email, and it was a dedicated email account. So when Laura eventually, I mean, she spent ages, like months, plucking up the courage. And when she did email, we left the country. And so it was 2 weeks before I got back to her, before I checked my email to. And so, you know, that was a long
was
2 weeks.
Really, really scary time, because in that time I was like, what did I say that was wrong? Oh, I put a kiss at the end of my email. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Oh, no.
Wow. So it's just, yeah. Oh, gosh.
It seems like it. I don't know, it feels archaic, doesn't it, even talking about it? It seems like there's so much logic to it. I guess we've not talked specifically about your children, your shared children. I'm not sure is there some sort of parlance? Is there some sort of etiquette around?
Our boys.
Your boys. The boys. With a Z, because we're street in East Scott. We're down with the kids.
The kids would say cringe.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's hashtag cringe these days, but yeah, I think it's definitely cringe. Sorry.
Or okay, boomer.
Yeah. Ooh.
Controversial.
I'm Gen X.
I don't know.
Yeah, you're Gen X.
Okay, cool.
I guess my thoughts are that the conversation, we're talking here about, you know, we've got the view of a birth parent, we've got the view of an adoptive parent, but ultimately the gold standard, you know, when we look at the legislation, is about the needs of children. And so in the midst of all that, where did that, was that kind of the front and centre of everything? How does this best serve the needs of children?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, right from there's a social media tsunami coming at us. We need to kind of get ahead of that. That was about making sure that the boys had every knowledge that they needed so that they didn't have to go into teenage years not knowing stuff about who they are. And so I think that's where the name Two Good Mums come from, is because all along the way, Laura has done absolutely everything she can to be a good mum, to do everything right for the boys. Yeah.
Yeah. And the reason I think I mentioned before we started interviewing, I've been talking to birth parents, and some of them find themselves in a really difficult situation post-adoption. Really, that they sort of feel like the best thing I can do for my child is to disappear for the next 18 years. That's in the best interest. And so was that how you were feeling, or how did you reconcile all of that, Laura, make sense of all of that?
I never felt like that myself, but I guess I didn't quite know that I would even play a role in their lives. I thought, right, I'd just been put in the position of not being in their lives, not me choosing to personally be out of their lives. So I didn't think I had a choice.
Yeah.
I could never have imagined in my wildest dreams that this is what would come of it. And so at the start, I was very much, it took a lot. I had to let the boys go in a way. At the start, for me personally, I didn't feel like a mum anymore. I really had an issue with people calling me a mum, because I didn't feel like one, because I didn't get to do anything that was a normal mum got to do. And so that's kind of how it affected me. I never felt like I needed to be out of the boys' lives, but I kind of felt like I just was anyway.
And what about, because we're all human beings, we all have our own opinions. Has there been a point where it's like been tenuous between the two of you?
Not from my point of view. Right. Go on, Laura, speak your piece.
No, it really hasn't. Not from us two, no.
No. See, that's really good to hear.
Sorry, scandal there. No.
Well, I wasn't looking for the scandal.
Harder.
I mean, the fact that Peggy, you mentioned Beth Neal earlier, and I think, you know, we've had Beth Neal on a couple of times, and I've listened to her speak as well at conferences and stuff. And what's clear is that each family or each story is going to be slightly different, maybe majorly different, etc. And so far, from the people that I've spoken to who actually have the relationship that like yours, that actually there tends not to be that kind of relationship where it could be a bit feisty and flighty and, you know, tenuous. And in actual fact, that what's important is the young people or the children or the, you know, teenagers that share the parents. And I think that's human nature, I think, isn't it? You know, we can fall out with our partners, but then we live with our partners. But actually, when it comes to something like this, you want your children to get the most out of it that you can. And I think once you commit to that kind of contact, and I use the word contact because that's what we would generally use as a word, but once you commit to that, there's really no going back. I mean, I don't think I would ever go back if I had that kind of situation.
I think if I'm hearing you correctly, you're assuming that there's some effort involved in it.
No. I'm saying that it's like, you know, once you've made that kind of commitment to your children to do this, that actually,
it's not hard though. Is my point. It's, for Laura and I, our relationships evolve so much that we forget to talk about the boys really quite a lot actually. So there's no kind of like, oh, I must do the right thing by the boys. Maybe at the beginning, yes, definitely.
That,
right. Yeah. That drove it. Yeah. And it still drives a lot of decisions. What's the best thing? Like, you know, it's you know, thinking about, it's trying to anticipate questions they might ask and sort of making decisions and choices around that. But equally, it's kind of, we've been doing it so long, it's just a natural friendship now, isn't it, Laura? Isn't it, Laura?
Yeah, it's just, like you say, at the beginning it was very much about the boys because they were young and they were quite a central part to it. But now that we've developed our friendship, and especially with the two good mums, outside of that, it generally only comes down to them when they're involved as such. And that's not to say that we haven't, along the way of two good mums, Peggy's still gone back to the boys and checked at every opportunity and point, you know, is this okay? Is this okay? Is
yeah.
this okay? They will still be first and foremost.
Yeah.
But I think as they're older and we've just sort of grown into this way of life, it's like Peggy says, it's just so natural now.
Mm.
And they will tell us if there's something, you know. I know that they'll go to Peggy and tell her if there's something that isn't right. So
and vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll go to them. There's something not right.
I mean, I think it's sort of seen as an exceptional circumstance, isn't it? But I think increasingly, it's not. And so was there an element of risk as well in making yourselves public? Because you're quite identifiable as a couple of women.
Apparently our voices are very identifiable.
Apparently I've got an accent.
Well, yeah, we know that feeling, don't we, Scott?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
So was there an element, I mean, there's not a sense of risk of your relationship, but kind of, you know, putting yourself out there, does that add pressure or does that change the dynamic at all?
I wouldn't say it shares the dynamic between us, but you're right. It was particularly for me. Laura's younger generation, so is more out there on social media and internet and everything. Whereas I'm very much the opposite of that. So I correct me if I'm wrong, Laura, but I think it was a bigger deal for me.
Yes.
To be public. Yeah.
Mm. But then you've got the added element of when you're identified, so are the boys. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting because the people that I know locally or that know the boys don't know about the podcast. Even if they're friends who are adopters, they don't know about the podcast. And, you know, I'll share with people in Australia. it's an interesting dilemma for me, really. But with, Laura might be getting some national publicity for her book. And so that was the next level of opening up. And, you know, and that, so it was like, oh, gosh, that really does identify me and the boys. And so it was another conversation, you know, around the dinner table with my husband as well.
But there's a clear sense of cause, isn't there, and mission that you've both got.
Mm.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think that's bang on. It's a case of the greater good. And we think that by sharing our story, because I think we are unusual, that hopefully we can help other people to think about it. I mean, that's the feedback we've got is that, you know, oh, okay, we understand in theory about post-adoption contact, but we couldn't work out how it was in practice.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, my experience as a family is that we had contact with birth family, like physical contact ultimately. But one of the things for us is our children, it was the most normal thing in the world. Because that's all they'd ever known. You know, that was their version of normal. They couldn't quite understand how other people were living and why they didn't have all these, you know, these kind of extended family members in different places. It's a really peculiar life. So have your boys, is that their sense of this is just how it is?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just normal.
That's good.
It's not strange at all.
It's good, because how old are they now?
To the point where it's once Laura and her family were actually staying at our house. CJ, we spent most of his time on an iPad, and we had to say, "Oi, get off!" You don't get to see him very often. I mean, that's what it's like. Or, you know, with the pandemic, we'll be Zooming, and you know, come on, Mummy Laura's on the Zoom. Oh no, I'm playing the Xbox. You know, it's just, you know, classic teenage.
Yeah, I've seen her. I've seen her once.
Yeah. Well, and suppose it's no greater compliment can be paid, can it? You know, that kind of familiarity of like whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's a testament to the fact that he knows that I'm not going anywhere.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting days we're living in, isn't it?
I mean, like really interesting and amazing story, and the way you speak about it as well. You know, clearly it's just a mutual thing that's developed into what is a friendship, you know. And you know, I'm in awe of both of you, actually. And I'm sure there will be a lot of people, you know, from your own podcast and by talking to us as well, who will think the same. What would your message be, though, to somebody who's thinking, I wonder if, what if I was to, from both of you really, but Peggy first, because obviously you did it.
We, and at the time we did it, we were doing it against, although the theory said it was a good idea, the vibe from the social workers was very much, sucking air through teeth. shaking the head and, this will test the boundaries, it didn't. I think own it, be bold. I think that, small steps and close boundary, because you can always open up. It's much harder to reel it in again. But I can't see what's wrong with sharing a dedicated email address. I can't see any harm in that.
It's pretty safe, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
Can I ask what the feedback has been? I mean, because Laura, you mentioned feedback from birth parents, which I totally get. Or is it that, are you stretching some adopters and some of them are kind of like, not so sure, I want to listen to that, or?
The main feedback that we've had is from trainee social workers for some reason.
That's good.
And or social workers in general. But secondary to that, the people that we hear from most are prospective adopters. And they more or less always, in fact, always probably, just say how amazing it is to have that first person account that we've given. Because they, as Peggy said earlier, they couldn't picture it themselves. They couldn't see how it would work and how to go about it, and us sharing our journey and our story has given them little pointers on how that they might be able to start it. I think it's a lot of them seem to be getting it suggested to them by their social workers as well, which indicates that social workers are also opening up to that, the possibility of contact becoming more open, which is really good to hear.
That's encouraging.
That is a really amazing thing to hear.
It's the millenniums, isn't it?
Millennials.
Scott's been talking to me all day about millennials, haven't you?
I am a millennial.
Yeah.
But
that is a really positive thing to hear, because I think that the kind of assumption is that social workers are very wary of it, or they were very wary of it. And to hear that, that is a really positive thing. But also, prospective adopters who we sometimes pick up on little things, I sit on an adoption panel, and when they're talking about various things, I may pick up on maybe their lack of kind of realism in terms of the future. So, as an example, something that a behavior might never disappear for a child, kind of thing. So we're picking on that. So actually, do you think we're not giving social workers and prospective adopters the kind of the acknowledgement that they deserve, that they're actually finding out about this stuff now and they're actually trying to be quite positive about it?
I would definitely say I had a recent-ish now. I'd like to say it's more recent, but it's actually like 2 years now since my daughter was born, and we had social services involved again. And I was hoping things had changed, and in some respects they had and in others they hadn't. But the one thing that really stuck in my mind this time round is that I used to think that the social workers were the bad people in all of this. I used to put a lot more power in their hands than what they really truly have. And this most recent sort of dealing with them with my daughter, I realized that the social worker is really just the curtain. And the wizard behind that curtain is the panel that you never, ever get to see.
Right. Okay.
And all they can do is they can get to know you, they can write down how they feel, and they pass it on, and they are not the decision makers. And I'm not going to go to bat for all of them, because there will be bad ones out there. But I really would encourage people not to assume that they're all bad, because we've had a lot of really positive feedback from adopters saying that their social workers are telling them to listen to our story because of the open adoption aspect. And then we've heard from trainee adopters who clearly want to do things vastly differently than what's is being done now. So the next generation of social workers, and even some of them now, are far better than people are giving them credit for. And I think they just have a massively bad rep from the bad ones.
Yeah. I think we're seeing that amongst some adoptive parents as well, who kind of perhaps had a perception of parents, and that perception is sort of slowly altered, and maybe as they get a bit older themselves, they perhaps see things differently, and they're not as necessarily, I think, insecure. I think adopters can be insecure, and that can hamper their willingness to share a child. I want to be number one dad or number one mum or whatever. And I think that wears off after 10 years. That ship has sailed. But then the thread's gone. The thread's in a sense has died. That you can't then pick it up because too much water's gone under the bridge. Anyway, it's not about our opinions, is it?
No, definitely not. No, but it's good to have that kind of conversation about what we, you know, how we think things are moving on. I think
it's encouraging.
Yeah,
it's really encouraging.
It's odd that you say that about adoptive parents, because one of the I don't remember a lot about our first meeting, as was made clear when we did the podcast. But one of the few things that I do remember is, I'm not sure if Peggy remembers this, is I actually told Peggy and Chris at that meeting that, and it was just CJ at that point, I remember telling them, CJ is your son, I don't want you to think that I'm ever going to try and get in the way. I will never ever try and do anything bad about that. Like, I can't remember my specific words, but the basic point that I was trying to get across to her is, please don't see me as threatening, because that's not what I want. You know, I, as a birth mum, very much saw these people as they were the ones that were going to give CJ the love that I wasn't allowed to give him. So why on earth would I direct any hate towards them? I never have, I never will. There are some birth parents out there that do, but hopefully adoptive parents will try and give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, I mean, there's a myriad of reasons why children come into care, isn't, and I know that, I mean, that was another question. Did you get support in relation to the loss of your children?
No, I didn't. Social services, the last time I saw them, I saw them last at the first meeting with Peggy and Chris, and then again with a gap in between, I saw them at the second meeting, and then I never saw them since, never heard from them in between, was never told about any support services. I was just left, and it wasn't until Peggy herself many, many years later actually offered me the opportunity to have therapy, that she and Chris paid for. That was the first time I ever got any kind of support therapeutically for it.
So it begs bigger questions, doesn't it, that we've got young women, because it's predominantly young women, who are sort of left to get on with it. And if they can keep themselves on the straight and narrow, or get themselves on the straight and narrow, then there's hope that contact can be something. But for some young people, that's just, for a myriad of reasons, they can't. And it raises a big question. I mean, that's maybe a wrong question to ask. It's a silly question to ask. But what would you hope for these young women? You probably would hope that young women would never get into those circumstances. So it's a daft question. But what would you hope for them?
I would hope that they are told about all of the support out there. I genuinely believe that any birth parent shouldn't be allowed to be signed off from the social services, no matter what the outcome, without some kind of booklet or leaflet or some kind of information having to be passed to them, or for them to actually, for it to be the social services responsibility to put them in touch with someone who can help them. Obviously, I know myself that therapy and things like that, they don't work unless you're ready for them. So there are going to be parents out there that don't want to immediately jump into it because that won't be right for them. But I don't think it's right to just let them go and find their way in the world, and especially after something as traumatic as losing a child to adoption.
Yeah. Peggy, last words. Come on then, before we wrap it up.
I guess as an adopter, I'd encourage other adopters to meet, if you can, to keep the open mind, and to not be scared of it. There you go. Concise. Unusual. Hey,
concise and to the point.
Hey, it's obviously an alien concept to us too, but we can go with that. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Yeah, absolutely.
It's been eye-opening.
Yep. So,
okay. One last plug for Laura's book then, Amazon.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. We'll put the link in. What's it called, please, Laura?
It's called Baby of Mine, A Birth Mother's Journey Through Forced Adoption.
Excellent. Well, we shall point people towards it and ring the bell for it. And thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.